critics are calling Pet Sematary one of the best Stephen King movies ever.
The Pet Sematary brings things back.
It's a deeply sinister nightmare.
Are you afraid of me, Mommy?
Pet Sematary, directed by Kevin Kelch and Dennis Whitmire. Rated R, in theaters this Friday.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about providing support for families after they adopt. It's an important topic. It's one I feel really passionate about, so I hope you enjoy the show. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the Executive Director of Creating a Family, and we are the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. And this show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, or not our corporate, actually, they're not a corporate. It's underwritten by Jockey Being Family Foundation. Their mission is to strengthen adoptive families through post-adoption services. Their founder is Deborah Waller, who is the chairman and CEO of Jockey International. She is also an adoptee. And she has a saying, one failed adoption is one too many. And all I can say is, amen. You can support their mission by buying a bear or a cute little blanket at their website, jockeybeingfamily.com, and we thank them for their support. This show is brought to you by, yes, our underwriters, and also people like you who make donations, but it's also supported by our partners. These are agencies who believe in our mission and are willing to back their belief with their dollars, and we truly couldn't do what we do without them. Some of our wonderful partners include Adoptions from the Heart. They have helped build over 6,000 families since 1985 through domestic infant adoption. Now, they can work with people throughout the United States, but they're fully licensed in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Delaware, Virginia, and Connecticut. We also have Spence Chapin. They are a licensed and accredited nonprofit organization in the New York City metro area that has been offering adoption services for more than 100 years. Yeah, think about that, 100 years. They have a really robust post-adoption services that they provide to really all members of the adoption triad, birth parents, adoptive parents, and adoptees. And that is really important in the world of adoption, and it's certainly important and relevant to the topic of today's show. As I said, we're going to be talking today about supporting families after they adopt. Those of you who have listened to this show for very long know that this is an area that I feel really passionate about. It has been a real focus for Creating a Family for the last 3 years. I mean, it's always been something that we've done and believed in. But we've been putting a lot of our time and effort and research into what works, what doesn't work, how we can do it, how we can get to families. Today we're going to be talking with three really big names in the field of adoption. It's going to be a fun exploration of ideas. First, it's going to be Deborah Waller. You heard me mention her just a minute ago. She is the Chief Executive Officer of Jockey International, but she also is the founder of the underwriter for this show, but Jockey Being Family Foundation, and their mission really focuses on post-adoption services. Also, Rita Sorenen. Rita is the president and CEO of the wonderful Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. They do so much good work in the area, particularly of foster families and finding families for harder-to-place foster kiddos. And last but certainly not least is Susan Cox. She is Vice President of Public Policy at Holt International. She also serves on the board at Creating a Family. This talk, this panel that we had, was really a kind of a test run of what became a keynote that we, all of us, did at the National Adoption Conference. We thought it was so useful and for all of us, and it was fun, and it's fun to talk with people who all feel passionate about the same thing. It was first aired 2 years ago. Then we ended up doing a keynote based on this, and so we're bringing it back to you now. It is truly an evergreen topic, as they say, and equally as relevant to now as it was 2 years ago. I hope you enjoy it. Let me welcome you now, Susan and Deborah, to Creating a Family Show. We are so glad to have you guys both on. This is a show that I have truly been looking forward to. This is a topic that it feels like the pool I swim in, and in particular, we talk about it all the time here amongst the staff at Creating a Family because it's one of our core missions, and it's going to be our focus for 2016. And we also talk about it a lot in our extensive online communities. And Rita was on a show just a couple of months ago. Actually, it was the lead-in show to our two-week celebration where we were celebrating our celebrating our 1 millionth listener. And we had Rita on talking about exploding myths of foster care. And we started talking. We got a couple of questions that talked about the lack of post-adoption support. And so, Rita, you and I started talking about it. And then afterwards, the conversation just continued and on our support group and certainly in our offices as well. And there was such interest that we decided that we would devote an entire show to it, both because there's a tremendous interest in the adoptive parent community, but also amongst the adoption professional community, of which we a large number of them are part of this audience as well. So I am so very thankful that you are on the show and that we're going to be talking. You are both on the show and that we're going to be talking about this today. We're going to be basically following the title, which I realize is not terribly creative, but nonetheless, the outline more or less is going to be: we're going to start talking about needs. Then we're going to move to where we see the gaps, and then we're going to end up brainstorming solutions, which is the part I must say I'm most looking forward to. But let's start at the beginning, as we usually try to do. Deborah, why do we need post-adoption support, or what types of adoptive families are most in need of these services?
excuse me. This is Deborah. All adopted families need post-adoption support, whether it's right after an adoption takes place or it could be many years down the road. And what brings a family to post-adoption support could be many, many different things. It could be, they're having trouble with behavior, or they may be having trouble with not understanding why a child may behave the way they're behaving at that particular time. Sometimes, though, it's hard to tell the difference between whether it's a child going through, their teenage years, or if they're going through the normal growing up process that a child would do. So I think every family needs post-adoption services, and that's why we had founded Jackie Being Family, because we found that post-adoption services were not prominent, and families were dissolving. A lot of these families will go through the adoption process and find that maybe they can't meet a child's needs, and they end up going back into the foster care system. And so we have chosen that the post-adoption arena is something that's very critical to bubble up to these families, to know that they're not out there by themselves. They're not alone. They have the support out there.
I'm you can't see me, but I'm standing up and giving you a standing ovation right now. Yes, yes,
oh,
yes.
Thank you.
We are doing one, we've done a informal, the last actually month and a half, we've been doing, or I guess about a month, we've been doing an informal survey of our audience and our online community about post-adoption support, and you'll be hearing me refer to some of it. And I'll have to admit, one of the things that surprised me was I was mainly thinking when we were developing the questions for the survey, I was mainly thinking of families who had adopted older children through foster care or international adoption. That was really where my mind was. And so I was somewhat surprised by the number of domestic infant adoptive parents who responded and responded where their needs were. So I'm really glad that you said that it is all families, and something I think to remember that it's not just that the need goes across the board, although I think perhaps it would be fair to say that the most critical need is for families who have adopted older kiddos from foster care or internationally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the other things that we've noticed, and I'd like to get your opinion, Rita, as well as Deborah, on this one. We have been noticing in the last, and I can't pinpoint a number of years, but the last number of years, that there's been something of a changing face of who is trying to adopt, primarily trying to adopt from foster care. We're seeing more people coming into foster care adoption
from infertility treatment, directly from infertility treatment, because domestic infant adoptions are costly, are harder to come by, and international adoptions, we all know, are certainly on the decline from the numbers, and the needs of the children are really, quite frankly, mirroring the needs of the kids in foster care. So, and many of these people, as I said, are coming from infertility, and they seem so unprepared for the realities of parenting kids who, I guess as Deborah Purvis calls it, come from hard places, you know, kids who've experienced abuse and neglect. Rita, are you over at the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption also seeing that this change of the demographics of people who are approaching foster care adoption?
We are, and we have been for a number of years, and you're right, and thank you for being persistent about this conversation. It is so important. We are seeing that changing face. We're seeing more single parents stepping forward. You're right. Folks that have gone through issues of infertility and maybe decide to consider domestic foster care adoption. Older families, families who have perhaps already raised maybe biological children and are still thinking, gosh, you know what, I've still got room in my heart and my home for more children, and so are considering older youth. So it's absolutely a changing face of foster care adoption. And I'd like to think it's because all of us have done a better job of raising awareness about the children in foster care who are waiting to be adopted. So absolutely. And the challenge is, of course, I agree with Deborah so much. Every family who adopts for reasons of issues of identity, of loss and grief, you know, all of those things that children grow through, whether they're adopted at birth or adopted out of foster care, become part of their who they are as a person as they grow up. And so all families, I think, who go through adoption need to understand what support services are there for them. But you're right, particularly for children who have experienced trauma, who have experienced multiple moves in foster care, who still know members of their family and feel issues of perhaps betrayal if they've been freed for adoption or being adopted by another family. All of those issues go into that complex human psyche of where do I belong? Who am I loyal to? Who am I? And that it shouldn't be at all shameful or scary or hard for a family to find services in order to help address these issues.
Yeah, and then we'll talk about where there is a lack later, but you're exactly right. One of the questions we ask on our informal survey was what type of support were people looking for? Did they feel like they needed or wanted? And it broke out into roughly kind of four areas. One was local services and financial support to pay for the services. And then tied with that was a listening, said different ways, but a listening ear or to not feel alone, as Deborah said, encouragement, that type of support. And then also the third one was resources to help educate them on the issues they're facing. And then we broke that one out and asked specifically what they were seeking education on, but we'll talk about that later. And the last was kind of the whole genre of respite care, just a break. Mm-hmm. So those were the four areas that we heard. Deborah, anything else that you mm-hmm. would lump into the genre of post-adoption support as what people might need or want?
Well, I would say that what we found was working with some of our nonprofit partners that parent groups are very important. And it's good to know that you're not the only parent swimming upstream, for example. And the parent groups are very important, and we work with the North American Council on Adoptable Children, and they have parent groups across the country. And while it's a nice parent group for the support, they also get educated at the same time where they can spread out what they've learned about adoption or post-adoption services to other parents. And then they get a network going. It's a community network where if someone has an issue and they remember talking to someone, they could pick up the phone and say, you know, I have a similar issue. Can you help me? So it really spans out more the roots, for example, the roots of being able to connect with other people that may be in a similar situation, and then you feel there, and then there you get the listening, and then you get the encouragement, and then you get the support. And then we do the resources by working with our nonprofit partners to help get those types of services out to them. Because it's very important that parents realize and know that they're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And one of the core missions of Jockey Being Family is to prevent adoption dissolutions, or sometimes also called adoption disruptions. There's actually a technical difference between the two, but we find that people use the words interchangeably. So how does post-adoption support factor into this? And Deborah, I'll direct this to you since I'm specifically speaking of one of your core missions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what we do is we work with some nonprofit partners. One I just mentioned was NACAC, the North American Council on Adoptable Children. And we brainstorm with a lot of our partners on how to better get the message out to these families. And like I said earlier, one failed adoption is one too many. And it's very important that a family or even a child knows that once they get into an adopted family, that that's their forever family. I don't know if you're aware, but I was adopted as a young baby. And so I grew up never, ever having that air of if I ever did anything wrong, that I would go back into the foster care system. And that's what we want to prevent. We want to give the knowledge and the training to families to understand that, you know what, look, you know what, it may be difficult now, but you know what, there's always help out there to get through through some of these issues. And so we developed the Community Champions Network, and we've also developed a youth speak out team, which is where these young adults, they get together and they're able to speak and they learn to share their story with people in order to affect change long term on the adoption process. And we also work with CASE, the Center for Adoption Support and Education, and we do conferences for kids and families and parents. And that we spend, we've done 8 of them so far, but we spend time with the children, and then we spend time with the parents, and they split up during the day. We have activities for the children and activities for the parents, and by the end of the time they get back together at the end of the conference, it's amazing to see how the changes between the parents and the children transform in just a matter of an 8-hour day. And then we also do strengthening family webinars where people can families can go online and hear, you know, different topics. If they have a specific topic, they can go online and learn about those topics. And then we also have a training adoption competency program that we're working with CASE, and I think, Dawn, you mentioned it earlier, on how to have a training program for specialists so that when a family goes in and talks to a specialist, that they understand that they've been through the adoption competency training so that they know that they're speaking and hearing from someone that can give them information or even guidance, the best guidance that they know how to give. And then, of course, we work with the Dave Thomas Foundation on many items. A couple in particular, we put a guide together for the American Academy of Pediatricians, and it's helping foster and adoptive families cope with trauma. Rita had mentioned that just a little bit ago. But that's a pamphlet that we hand out to pediatricians that have been really widely used, and it's been very instrumental in helping pediatricians and families to better understand and identify traumatized children, and it's been very helpful. And then we're also developing – it's wonderful. And then the child care providers and caregivers, we're also doing a booklet on that, and that gives the caregivers, you know, how do you take care of children, and how do you do that? So I think all of these things that we're trying to do for families is the number one thing is to keep them together, and then the next thing is that when there's an issue that they have a place to go and that they're being supported.
And let me throw out there that for our audience who is interested in some more information on the difficult subject of adoption dissolution and adoption disruptions. We did a couple of years ago, a really interesting show on, the title was Adoption Dissolutions, How Common, What Are the Causes, and How to Prevent. And we had three guests, Dr. Trudy Fessingers, which she is one of the leading researchers, academic researchers on, well, adoption in general, but in specific. She has specialized in dissolutions and disruptions. And we also had Stephen Hayes. He is an adoption attorney who specializes in this topic and also trains other adoption attorneys in the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys. And then Regina Kopecky, who's both a therapist specializing in adoption and attachment, as well as co-author of Adopting the Hurt Child and Parenting the Hurt Child. And I really do recommend that show. It was very informative, and there's a lot we don't know, but there's a fair amount that we do know as well. So a good topic and a good resource. Let me bring in now another guest, Susan Cox. She is Vice President of Public Policy and External Affairs at Holt International, the oldest and largest intercountry adoption agency in the world. Susan was adopted from Korea in 1956, and her life experience as an early international adoptee gives her a unique experience and perspective on this topic. And she is a member of the Hague Special Commission on Intercountry Adoption. And I might add that she serves on the board of Creating a Family, the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. Hey, welcome, Susan.
Good morning. Thank you.
We're talking about post-adoption support and where the needs are and what type of support do people need. From an international adoption standpoint, where do you see the need for post-adoption support? What type of support is helpful to families?
Well, I think one of the things to always remember is that adoption is a lifelong experience. So it isn't that the child comes into your home or you're adopted, the adoption's finalized, and it's over. It really is a continuum. And we certainly see that as children get into pre-adolescent and adolescence, that's a time when children are just doing a lot of pondering and wondering about themselves, just generally. But for children who are adopted internationally and transracially, there are also the issues of race and nationality that they need to navigate. For the most part, these children don't look like the rest of their family, at least not the same as their mother and father. So the fact that they are adopted is right out there. And I can still remember being in a small little school and everyone knowing that I'd come to my family through adoption. I was the only Korean, or actually the only minority child in our community. But then when you go out into a bigger space where you're new, you're constantly having to explain to people how it is that you look the way you do and that your family does not. And so I think those issues of race and nationality are just incredibly significant, and that it continues. It isn't just something that's over when you graduate from high school or college or get married. It reasserts itself at various points in your life. So I think it's important for parents who are adopting to understand, acknowledge, and embrace the fact that that's going to be a part of their adoption experience, and that it's important and critical that they acknowledge that as they're moving forward raising their child.
Yeah, and in addition to general support, we believe that people need resources. And so one of the questions we ask our community was what topics did they feel that they needed resources or information on, and their answers were interesting and probably not surprising to you three. The top one was behavioral issues, and the second one, but we actually think that by reading the comments that people were lumping these two together, and the second one was attachment, and we all know that insecure attachment, failure to attach, or just attachment issues in general can lead to behavioral issues. So we actually, in for the purposes of the survey, have lumped those together, and so that was by and far the largest one people were seeking information on. And keep in mind, this is post-adoption. Prenatal exposure issues also was one. Open adoption, was one, and that was across the board, perhaps with the exception of international, but it was for both families who are adopting from foster care as well as families who adopted domestic infants domestically. Transracial adoption, and then we had a category of other, and people, these are the ones that were written in, post-adoption depression, post-adoption grief. We got a number of people suggesting that is a topic that they want resources on. And let me just break here and mention that creating a family has extensive resources using every type of media, audio interviews, video, expert Q&As. We have resources on certainly post-adoption depression, as well as the second one, which was the second most popular write-in, was surviving the first year. Another one that somebody raised was more information from the adoptee perspective, then we had a couple of large families who have adopted a large number of kids through a sibling group, and just dealing with the dynamics of larger families. That was one that was written in, and then a couple of people asked for more resources on talking with kids about adoption and talking with kids about hard background information, and I will also add that creating a family has a lot of resources on that, on both the talking in general about adoption, but also very specifically, because we know that this is a need, talking with kids about the hard issues, rape, domestic violence, incarceration, incest, things like that that may be in the child's past. Rita, are there other things that you, other topics that you think families need resources on post-adoption?
Yeah, and you know, the one that seems ringingly obvious, and we're constantly talking, you know, another category of folks in addition to the ones that Deborah mentioned, teachers and physicians, is policymakers. You know, policymakers hold the keys to evidence-based policy on post-adoption services, but also the keys to financial resources. Sometimes a potential adoptive parent see that barrier to adoption is financial, and so just letting people know that things like the adoption tax credit exist, that virtually almost, I think, more than 90% of families who adopt from foster care have access to subsidies from their state for post-adoption resources. And sometimes the barrier to adopting older youth in a family's mind is, well, I haven't saved for college for this 15-year-old. How could I possibly put them through college? Well, you know, in almost all states, there are resources available for older youth who are adopted from care relative to college expenses. So that financial expenses is one sometimes we shy away from talking about because families don't want to admit that, you know, that's an important consideration. Well, it is an important consideration, mm-hmm. and there has been some movement to make sure that those dollars are available. Is it enough? Certainly never enough, right, to help these families. But we want to make sure that links to those resources and knowledge about those resources is available to families if they believe that financial is a burden to adopting.
That's such a good point.
Rita,
yeah.
I want to really add to what you've said, that the policymakers are so critical because that mm-hmm. helps to set the stage for whatever's going to happen. And also that they listen to the voices of the adoptees and the people who have lived this. And very often children, I think, adoptees are kind of frozen in time. They're considered as the babies and the adolescents, but in fact we do grow up, and we have some important information, I think, to share and opinions and views, and not necessarily adoptees who go on to become adoption professionals, but just the average everyday adoptee who has lived a variety of experiences. And I think we're getting better at listening to those voices, but that's something that I believe that always can be improved upon.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah. And, you know, we, through the foundation, we've supported a number of programs, including one through the Congressional Coalition, the Foster Youth Internship Program, a powerful voice on the Hill of providing mm-hmm. children who've either aged out of care or who have been adopted as interns for the summer for members of Congress, so they have a one-on-one relationship with the issue. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Susan.
Mm-hmm. We're going to mm-hmm. be doing a panel in first quarter 2016 of older youth, or no, of youth that were adopted at an older age from foster care. And I'm really looking forward to that as well. Just another mechanism for getting their voices out there. Another question that we were curious about and asked in our survey is, who is currently providing post-adoption support and resources? And we specifically ask it, the question was, where are you finding your support? And we, 6 months post-adoption, because we thought it was important to, we wanted it to be post-adoption, so once the rubber meets the road, as we say. And the results were interesting on this. And again, I'll stress this was an informal survey, so I mean that's important to keep that in mind. By far, the largest and by far I mean the overwhelming majority of people were getting their support in online adoption support groups. Now, I should mention that's partly one of the places we were seeking responses was there, but not only there. And so not across the board, but many people, that was their, they cited that. Websites, online websites, and we asked them to specify which ones. Friends and family, although when people commented, it seemed like friends and family were more often giving parenting advice, not necessarily adoptive parenting advice, but still an important source. And keep in mind that this, the list I'm going through is order of magnitude of how people answered. And I thought this was interesting. After those online support group websites, friends and family, came adoption agency, caseworkers, and social workers. And then came professional counseling. And interestingly, rather surprising, was the very last place was in-person adoption support groups. And I believe when we entered into discussion with people as to why that is, they are primarily only available in larger metropolitan areas. And quite frankly, families who are under a lot of stress often feel like they don't have the time or the energy. And as somebody said, that what I need is in the middle of the night when I'm not sleeping type of support. So I thought that was I found that was of interesting responses. Let me see if anybody else. Let's see, Susan. Do you have any other thoughts on where people are using? Does this surprise you? I should maybe ask it that way, as to the results of where people are currently finding their post-adoption support.
No, it doesn't surprise me, but I do have to say that it is disappointing that more agencies don't provide post-adoption support. And I know that it's expensive. I know it's time-consuming. I know that it takes resources. But I believe that agencies have a responsibility and an obligation that when they have worked with a family, that they're there for them beyond just the finalization. I think very often families, even going to an agency, they lose touch. And so sometimes the problems or the issues emerge during adolescence or years later, and they have tended to lose track of the agency and the organization. Encourage that if you've adopted through an agency, that families stay in communication, at least know where they are, know what's going on at the agency, so they can access services that are available. I fully believe that the Internet has become an incredibly important resource, and the idea of the physical support groups and parent groups, I think those have sadly diminished in the last few years. They're not as prevalent as they once were, but being able to get the support from somewhere 24/7, I think, is very valuable. But I also think that families, people need to sift through that information. Just because it's information that's out there doesn't mean that it's accurate or helpful. So I think that's also something to consider, as is anything about the Internet.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Don, this is Rita.
Yeah.
Sorry. We realized a couple of years ago just that issue. Where do people find this? And as you're sorting through the Internet, there's always, 10 more that pop up. We commissioned through the Donaldson Adoption Institute a report, Supporting and Preserving Adoptive Families, and its profiles of publicly funded post-adoption services state by state. So it's a comprehensive listing as of 2014. Now things change quickly, but a comprehensive listing at least for publicly funded support services in the state and where people can go for that information. information, and these were all thoroughly vetted and listed in the booklet. So it's at least one resource that people can grab onto as a comprehensive source as well.
And I'm going to link to that in the blog tomorrow. So for people who are listening, I will link to that. We actually have that linked already on our site, but I will specifically link it in the blog tomorrow.
This is Deborah. Could I add something?
Ahead. Please.
And when we're talking about the agencies, Jackie Bean Family right now is, we've launched a portal where the agencies can order backpacks. We do a national backpack program, and what we're trying to do is to get the agencies more involved in the post-adoption process, and with these backpacks, they can order online, and we fill the backpacks with information for the child. Well, we do, you know, a bear, a blanket, and some other items, but then there's a parent tote that is included in that, and then we have, a couple of books, Beneath the Mask, a Wise Up workbook, and several other different things where the agencies now can become more involved in that post-adoption service. And right now we have over 200 agencies. We just launched our portal in October of 2015. Right now we have over 200 agencies in all 50 states. So we're hoping we can get a lot more information out there as time moves on, and we're going to be trying to get the long-term goal is to get 50,000 backpacks out annually to each adoption so that the agencies and the parents have that information. So hopefully that will grow as time goes on.
It's a great idea, in particular providing parents with the resources that they can use and go to. I want to move us now to the identifying gaps, and I'm going to do this a different way. I was going back this morning through the all the comments that we received on this survey, and it was both enlightening and, quite frankly, a little heartbreaking in ways, and I decided that we had so many comments that I went through and selected it's more than I should have, but I just a tiny, tiny number compared to the numbers that we got. And I want to read them because I think it's it probably better than anything identifies the gaps. We asked people to let us know what type of adoption as well, so and I think most of them did. So we asked what type of adoption support they got post-adoption. That was the question. And Hannah responded, "We adopted from foster care four kids ages 7 to 10 at adoption. After adopting, we were pretty much on our own. We did have a lot of friends at church who cared about our family, and I knew several families who adopted older kids and adopted transracially, and I called and asked them questions. I was close friends with someone who was adopted at age 7, and I called and asked her questions. But mainly, I haunted online groups and your website." And this is from Jennifer. "We adopted our daughters via foster care at 3 years of age. We received a flyer on post-adoption services and a name and number to call for crisis intervention should we need it. Aside from that, we have received no post-adoption support from our agency. I turned to a handful of Facebook groups, such as this one, for support, and a bonus is that I've also learned a lot, too, about online resources." And this from Kathy, who adopted a 12-year-old from foster care. "We received no support at all. Both the Texas caseworker and our local agency caseworker said that once the adoption was final, we were on our own. I left a message recently just wanting to give them an update, and my call was not returned. I guess they were serious. We are lucky that we've had no major issues." And Jenny says, "We adopted a teen from foster care with severe mental issues, and I have received no official post-adoption support. I had to figure things out for myself. I joined a local adoption support group and researched online. And no, it was not enough, and things are still very rocky." And from Katie, "We adopted 7 between the ages of 1 and 7 at placement. We had both state and private caseworkers that aided us until finalization was making sure that we had services, therapies, or diagnosis of special needs in place. We also had wraparound services through a ministry that supports foster and adoptive families with meals, babysitting, etc. Once we finalized, all support from state and agency was gone, so during the time building up to that, they really pushed hard to getting things in place, like a FASD, fetal alcohol syndrome diagnosis, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, diagnosis for one child. Everything disappeared completely after finalization. We are currently getting support from the doctors that treat our kids, from resources we've heard about from other parents, such as horse therapy and weekend conferences for parenting kids with trauma, and, of course, online resources. And from Christine, we adopted two kids internationally through the same agency. There was no post-adoption follow-up or support. We just figured things out on our own. And for a brief time, I joined a local adoption support group, which disbanded just about as soon as it started. I did, however, make friends with other parents of internationally adopted children, both in person and on this group, and I've learned the most through them. And from Jennifer, I'm going to continue to, I don't have that many more, but I was so touched yet again when I read these, so I am going to read, honestly, just three more, or maybe four more. From Jennifer, we adopted twins from Ethiopia and had no support whatsoever when we came home. We live in Illinois, and our adoption agency is located in another state, but our home study agency is located only 15 minutes from us, but they offered no help. I turned to other adoptive parents on the internet for help, as well as read everything I could find online. thank you for your resources, especially your resources on attachment. Robin, we've had done two international adoptions, no post-adoption support whatever, except for a list of books they said I might want to read. I found on my own a variety of listservs and, of course, this online group. Thank goodness for this group. And I didn't want to leave us with only depressing news because, in fact, there were a couple of people who actually had very good experience, and I did want to read two of those. One was Jocelyn. She said, we adopted a teen from foster care. We received support from our private agency, a counselor for our son, a family counselor, and this online support group. Oh, and Cafe Mom's online support group as well. We also have received support from our family and our church family. We managed to weather through food issues, lying, bullying, and developing an open adoption relationship with his birth mom. We can still access these resources from our agency 2 years after finalization. And Carmen said, we adopted our son at age 4 from DHS, Department of Human Services. We have a post-adoption group in our area. Everyone is very supportive. The group offers training, a lending library, and even just coffee and chat. The group also offers social activities for the kids, such as Halloween carnivals, etc. It lends itself to great networking amongst the parents. Our caseworkers have also kept in touch and are still available to answer questions or concerns or refer us to services. We realize how fortunate we are. So, on that, I don't know that we need to talk too much more about gaps, since I think that that more or less clearly identifies them. And honestly, of course, the question may have solicited people who had a beef, you know, who were not receiving support, but it was truly overwhelming. We did not have too many people who reported a real supportive situation, which was, it just tells us where our work is. So we can talk about gaps, but let's move the discussion in perhaps. Actually, I am negligent here. I need to be talking a little more about us. You are and reminding people that you are listening to creating a family. Today we're talking about post-adoption support, the needs, the gaps, and the solutions. Creating a Family has the largest adoption and infertility communities on the social network, and we would love to have you join us. Clout Now, which is the online expert ranker, now ranks us as the number 2 online influencer worldwide in the areas of both adoption as well as infertility. There are 3 ways to connect with us on Facebook. You can like our Facebook page. You can join our very large and very active Facebook closed support group, or you can connect with me personally, dawn.davenport1. To find both the page and the group, you can just type in Creating a Family in the Facebook search box, and both will pop up. You can also find us on Pinterest and Twitter. We hang out both of those places, and you can find us there at Creating a Family. All right, now moving to talking about solutions. Let's talk some about what we think works as far as, you know, we've put a lot of emphasis on pre-adoption education, which I am a huge believer in, but the truth is we know that once families get home, we often call it when the rubber meets the road, and much of the education before is you can educate, but it's the educable moment is often when there is a need. Susan, what have you and at Holt and in your discussions both on the Hill and other places, what works? How do we reach families?
You know, it's such a challenge. One of the adoption tax credit that Rita referred to is important, but we really have to have some kind of dedicated funding for post-adoption services. I think there are a lot of agencies that would like to do more, but they feel that they don't have the resources. And I'm proud to say, actually, that Holt has made a real commitment to this, as we have, you know, we clearly are placing children internationally that have more special needs than they used to have. They're coming from countries where there have been serious trauma and institutionalization. So we have, you know, made the commitment that the children that we're being placed now, and particularly as families have to wait for so long, that means those children are also waiting in less than favorable circumstances. So we have a dedicated post-adoption services department. We're making as many contacts as we can with referrals for clinical services. We have, you know, some staff that actually provide clinical services as well, and trying to just stay as informed as possible. And part of what happens post-adoption is influenced by what happens in the pre-adoption time, when you're informing parents that this is part of what could happen, and to make them aware of the things that could happen once their child comes home in the different developmental stages. I think part of that really does happen in the adoption process, you know, prior to the child coming home. But things, you know, we feel that, you know, we have to do more, and we have dedicated a department to do that. We work through all of our branch offices and also through our cooperating agencies. And we feel like once children are home, they continue to need help and services, as do their parents. So, but again, I'd like to go back to the policy. We have got to find some reserves available for both federal and state level to help in this, in post-adoption. It also reflects back on family recruitment. When you hear those stories of families who adopted from foster care with all of the expectation of support after, and then repeatedly you heard them say, once the adoption was over, they had no help at all. Those stories get out, and it discourages families from going ahead and adopting kids that they might have otherwise considered.
Mm-hmm. Rita, thoughts on after the adoption is final, and you know, in particular, what we talk about so much here at Creating a Family is we have all these great resources by top experts in the United States. And we do it across all type of media. So, you know, people who are visual learners, people who want to read. How do we get, and we have this huge thriving support group that is so helpful. So how do we best get this information into the hands of parents when they're struggling?
Yeah, you're right. And the agency is key, whether it's a private agency, a public agency, a domestic adoption, an infant adoption, an international adoption. The agency that works with that family knows everything about that family and has a connection to that family. And they should also then be key to a link to resources post-adoption, stay involved with this family. You know, we've talked about the Wendy's Wonderful Kids program before, and those recruiters that are hired through that program stay with that family post-adoption to help them navigate post-adoption resources as well. Encouraging families and helping families understand that there is nothing wrong with asking for assistance. I think so many families feel like it's a failure if they have to reach out for assistance with their children. It's not a failure. It's a failure not to ask. And so encouraging that attitude from the get-go, pre-adoption, when you need help, here are the resources and I'm going to be here. Here's a consistent contact number. And I couldn't agree more with Susan. This is about having a dedicated federal funding stream that trickles to states so that post-adoption resources is as critical a conversation at a fiscal and policy level as it is pre-adoption and getting these kids adopted. So, you know, making sure that we've got, we have so many other programs that show nurse family partnerships or home visiting programs where when you have that one consistent connect to a family, they're much more likely to thrive and survive during difficult times. We need that same kind of program and resource available to families post-adoption.
And we do a good job, in particular, I think, with foster care adoption. The two most utilized pre-adoption education, MAP and PRIDE, do a very good job of pre-adoption education. International adoption, it's a bit more hit and miss, and some agencies require quite a bit, and some require just the minimum of 10 hours. So that's a bit of a separate issue. But you're right; it's the post-adoption, and it's hard because pre-adoption, you have a hook. You can say you can't adopt this child unless you complete this education. But post-adoption, we don't have that and shouldn't have that. At that point, we can't force anybody to receive anything. And I think, is that part of the problem, is that we don't have the mechanism, per se, after the fact. Any thoughts on that, Deborah?
Well, as you're reading these stories, you can hear the frustration coming out of all these various experiences. And the message, I think it has a lot to do with education and better understanding what potentially they could be getting involved with. And I think these families, I think Rita's right, the agencies need to be more involved, and that's why we are trying to get the agencies involved. But then Susan's right, too. It takes a lot of money to do that. And so when these kids... I personally feel that I think adopted kids need to speak up, and that's why we did this Youth Speak Out team, because they're getting trained to tell and share their stories in a fashion where policymakers can hear what they have to say, and that's their story, and that's their experiences. And it's not everybody's experience, but it's enough of an experience where the policymakers need to hear. They need to listen. And think about a child going back and forth in between a family. They're going through the adoption process. It's a very happy day. And then a year or two later, they go back into the foster care system. Think about what that does to that family, the parents, the child. Then you've got other issues you have to potentially work with, whether it's, depression, whether it's, the feeling of rejection again. These parents need to have that kind of support. And I think the more we talk about it, I think the more it bubbles up, and I think the more awareness people have of it. And just like the stories that you read, maybe those people haven't shared that before. Well, that's a good thing that they wrote in and shared some of that, because it helps us as people who are really trying to keep these families together, gives us a direction on what they are looking for. Because if you go to a policymaker or if you go somewhere else, we may not hear the real needs versus what they truly need.
Right, and what they will find helpful. I'm sorry, who was getting ready to speak?
Right.
This is Susan. I think there is a moment, I believe, right now, and because of the really horrible stories that were exposed with rehoming, and many of the children had been adopted internationally, but some of them domestically as well. I think it's only the tip of the iceberg. We really don't know how extensive that problem is. But because that has been so public, I believe that people, members of Congress have been hearing about this, and it's something that needs to be addressed, and it's everywhere. It's not just in a few isolated pockets, but it did expose the real horrible gaps that there are and the lack of responsibility. And a number of those parents that, were interviewed in the Reuters story and another story since then say that they really felt like they had nowhere to go. And, listening to them, it seems like, but why didn't you go back to the agency? And if the agency couldn't help you, the idea that parents would rehome their children to strangers via the internet was just incomprehensible to me. And so then it goes back to, who did the home study? Who placed children with these families? So, I think it really identifies and exposes a more broader systemic issue within the whole institution of adoption.
you know, Susan, after the, and let's keep in mind that that Reuters story was, what, a year, almost two, it was probably 2 years ago now, wasn't it?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, we're saying things have, you know, it brought attention, but I haven't seen much change. At the time, shortly thereafter, we did a lot on this topic. And one of the things we did was, again, a survey of our audience asking that exact question about who do you turn to when you're struggling after adoption? And we found out that oftentimes people were not going back to their agency. So we dug further and said, so why are you not going back to your agency? And the three most common reasons given were, and I'm not sure this is an order of how they answered, but I remember the three very clearly. One was people were angry at their agency because they oftentimes felt like the agency had misled them or had let them down in some way. And when by misled, they felt like perhaps the full extent of the child's problems had not been disclosed. A second one was they were embarrassed because they felt like, and I believe this has already been raised here by Deborah, but embarrassed that they are needing help. And third, they felt like that if they admitted that they were struggling this much, they would never be able to adopt again, which might seem like an interesting thing, but it's I think the feeling that even if it's not working this time, I might want the option of adopting again. So if I fess up to having trouble, then that option, we will never be allowed to adopt again. Let me break really quickly and just say I need to take a moment to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and to remind you that it is through their generous support that we can bring you this show, as well as all the resources at Creating a Family. We have Nightlight Christian Adoptions. They have offices in California, Colorado, and South Carolina, and international adoption programs throughout the world, as well as a domestic infant program and their Snowflakes Embryo Donation Embryo Adoption Program. We have Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a Hague-accredited adoption agency placing children from around the world, offering home study and post-adoption services to North Carolina and New York. And we have the Independent Adoption Center, whose mission is to provide open adoption placement and counseling to birth and adoptive families. They work in families in all 50 states and are fully licensed in California, New York, Florida, Texas, and more. So any thoughts on who – we've talked about agencies, and I couldn't agree with you guys more. I think it's only fair now to throw out that there has certainly been – a movement in the last 10 years of churches stepping up to provide post-adoption support. They certainly stepped up to, and certainly in the beginning, they were more encouraging. It felt like, you know, being cheerleaders for the adoption process. But I have certainly seen a shift in the last probably 5 years to a lot more emphasis from churches in the evangelical Christian orphan care movement. Rita, have you guys seen that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's a powerful group to continue to engage in this conversation. And this is all about community, right? Family is the essence of community, and faith-based is so woven into communities internationally, domestically, that the faith-based community, I think getting them also engaged in this post-adoption conversation, and they're getting there, is critical, absolutely critical.
And let us, and I come back again because this is what we do, but online support is just, I mean, it's the way everything is moving. And so how do we make online support more effective, more available? Or let more people know that it already exists. I'd love to hear any of your thoughts. Deborah, I'll direct that one to you at this point.
What we're trying to do is, through our nonprofit partners, we put their website addresses on our website, which is www.jockeybeingfamily.com. So if you go to our website, you'll be able to see the nonprofit partners that we work with, where they can the parents or people could go and look and see what each one of them have to offer. And then I just think that we just have to continue bubbling this up. I think websites, while the internet is so perfect for this, I think it was Susan earlier said you have to be careful on what information you glean from that. And after you've been through the adoption process, you're probably pretty tired. And then you go, and then you have a situation that comes up, and then you're going, oh my gosh, now I've got to search the web, which is so vast to begin with. How can we narrow that down? And that's what we're trying to do. And I think that, but we just have to be repetitive, I think, and just keeping the word out there.
And another thing that's where we see a great need is for training adoption competent therapists. And the CASE, the Center for Adoption Support and Education, is doing a great job, again, with the support of, I'm not sure if both of your organizations, perhaps, on their training of their therapist. And we're going to be working with them to do our best to help get their listings out, because we certainly have the audience, because that's certainly something that we need, that everyone needs. And the last thing, something that we're kicking around, I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts on, is the idea of creating a warm line or a mentoring program, peer-to-peer support, and doing it on a national level. We're doing it through Creating a Family. This is only in the very, very, very beginning stages, and there's much to be thought of. I really just want to pick your brains as to, since I have you, pick your brains on to whether or not this is an effective way to meet the needs of these families. Let me start, Rita, we'll start with you, and then I'd like to kind of do maybe a round robin there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's nothing more important than a voice of understanding, a voice of expertise. Someone in the middle of the night or at, you know, at first of the morning or as the kids are getting ready for school, whatever it is, someone who understands what the challenges are and can give a direct, supportive, empathetic, understanding ear to the conversation. Way back when I started out in child abuse prevention a million years ago, you know, it was the 24-hour hotline that we staffed. And having that hotline available to individuals who are at risk of abuse saved lives. I think the same kind of warm line with foster care families, with international adoptive families, with any adoptive family can be a lifeline when they're at a crisis moment. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Susan, thoughts?
I think it's a wonderful idea. And I believe when you're talking about how do you get the word out, families, the adoptive families, and especially now with the internet, they are an incredible networking community. And I think that once they know that it's available, it's that, you know, wonderful second party endorsement that's going to say this is a place to go. And if it's consistent, if people can come back and really feel like they're getting something valuable, it will just, I believe, grow on its own. So, Dawn, I think that's a wonderful idea. I hope it's something that can really move forward.
And, Deborah, I'm going to give you the – we have come to the end. I'm going to give you the last word, and then I will continue talking after that. Just thoughts in general on the whole topic.
Well, I think the warm lines are absolutely critical for families. Also setting up portals. I know that the Community Champions Network have portals that are set up for parents or families to go into, and they're made private so that you know that these are adopted families that are going into that portal so that you can get that extra help whenever you need it. And so I think it's a great idea, because in the middle of the night, sometimes that's when a lot of things, they happen, and that's when your mind turns on, too. And so you have to talk to somebody at that 2 o'clock hour. And so I think those are critical for families to have. And the last thing I would say is that obviously we have a lot of work to do, and we still have a lot of work to do. And we're committed as Jackie Being Family to make sure that these families stay together. So we're looking forward to making sure these families get the information that they need.
Thank you, Rita Sorenen, Susan Cox, and Deborah Waller for being our guests today on Creating a Family. If you want to participate in a discussion of the topic of this show, check out my blog tomorrow at creatingafamily.org/blog. Let's keep the ideas coming and the discussion going. This topic is too important not to. To get more information on from about Susan or about Holt, you can go to their website, which is HoltInternational.org. To get more information about Rita Sorenen or the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, you can go to their website, which is DaveThomasFoundation.org. And don't forget to go buy yourself a Frosty or maybe an order of fries and drop your change into the canisters at the checkout. And heck, don't drop more than your change. Go ahead and throw a couple extra bucks in there as well. And to get more information about Deborah Waller or Jockey Being Family, you can go to their website, which is jockeybeingfamily.com. Thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to seeing you again next week.
Come to the Home Depot this month and you'll learn a thing or two. Actually, three, with three free do-it-yourself workshops. Learn how to design and care for your container garden by selecting the best soil and aesthetically arranging your plants. Learn how to install tile flooring, even how to keep your outdoor deck and patio space in the best shape possible. See, it's never too late to learn something new. Register today at homedepot.com/workshops for a do-it-yourself workshop near you. Only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing.
This February, history will be made. Millions will watch as 80 years of unjust stigma is left in the past. A product that drove good people to the black market will be revealed as one that's creating a new global market. This February, what inspired the symbol of counterculture will at long last be seen as just culture. The new normal is coming. Will you be one of the first to see it? Visit MedMen.com to watch an exclusive preview.